Just to you.
Good to see you all. Excellent. Wonderful. Hope everybody is doing well. I always debate what it is I'm going to talk to you guys because we never chose a curriculum for this year. And basically, whatever comes to my mind, that's what you're stuck with. So I gave it some thought towards the end of last week and over Shabbos and then again this morning. And I can't not talk about something that was in yesterday's Torah reading. I can't let it go. You know, if you made it to shul, then you're familiar. And if not, I'll fill you in. It's stuff that we're all familiar with. We read from Parshat Va'era. Parshat Va'era is the beginning of the 10 plagues. Seven of the 10 are in yesterday's Torah reading, and the final three will be, God willing, in this upcoming week's Parsha. But before the plagues are actually introduced, is we have the command. God comes to Moshe and he wants him to go speak to the Jewish people and let them know the time has arrived for the Exodus. The time has come. And we're familiar with a lot of the terminology because we make reference to it at the Seder over the holiday of Pesach. We sit with our families and we retell the whole story. What are we told? Here's what the verses tell us. Lochein emor lebnei Yisrael. Therefore, Hashem says, Moshe, go tell the Jewish people, Ani Hashem, I am Hashem. Vehotzeiti etchem mitachat sivlot Mitzrayim. And I will take you out from under the burdens of Egypt. Vehitzalti etchem me'avodatam. And I will save you from being their servants, being their slaves. Vigo'alti etchem bizra'a netuya u'bishvatim gedolim. And I will redeem you with an outstretched arm and with great judgments. V'lokachti etchem li la'am, I will take you for me as a people. V'hayiti lachem le'elokim, and I will be to you as a God. V'idatem, and you will know, ki ani Hashem Elokeichem, that I am Hashem your God. Hamotzi etchem tachat sivlot Mitzrayim, that takes you out from the underneath, from the burdens of Egypt. Why am I reading you all these verses? Because you'll note there are four different expressions. Just to recap, that Hashem tells Moshe to tell the Jewish people, number one, Vehotzeiti etchem, I will take you out from under the burdens. If you have a Chumash in front of you, this is the very beginning. It's chapter 6, verse 6. 6-6 in the book of Exodus, in Shemot. Number one is Vehotzeiti etchem, I will take you out. Number two, Vehitzalti etchem, and I will save you. Number three, Vigo'alti etchem, I will redeem you. And then number four is the Lokachti etchem, I will take you for me to me as a people, and I will be a God to you. We are very familiar with these as the four Lishonot Shel Geula, the four expressions of redemption. Where are we so familiar with this? Somebody tell me, what's our connection to these four terminologies, these four expressions? They
Four
come
cups.
to
Four cups.
yes. These is one of the reasons why we have four cups of wine at the Seder. They correspond to these four terminologies, these four expressions. Correct. I want to focus on these four, and we're going to break it up into three ideas. Okay? Before I move on, the truth of the matter is I ended one verse early. Because in verse number eight, I read you 6 and 7. Number eight begins, Vehevaiti etchem el haaretz, and I will bring you to the land, right? Let's follow the progression here. I will take you out from under the burdens. I will save you from their service. I will redeem you, and I will take you as a people. And number five is I will bring you to the land that to the land about which I raised my hand to give it to Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. And I shall give it to you as morasha, as an inheritance. Why? Ani Hashem. I am Hashem. I'm the Lord. So I just want to point out that there really are five expressions of redemption. We've bent out of shape, had to get the four to mesh. That's why it's the four cups. But
Thank you.
Mark, there's five terminologies here.
Yes.
What's the answer? You do know. Think about your Seder.
Of Elijah.
There you go. Many
Yeah.
commentaries say that that is the representation of the fifth cup that we fill for the cup of Elijah. Okay? We'll hold off on that for a moment. But there really are, in Judaic literature, it refers to it as the four expressions. We're going to talk a little bit as to why this fifth one is not really part of the equation, which we'll get to. Unless, you know what? Let's just do it first. Let's get it out of the way. Let's do that. I'm asking you a simple question. We read through the verses. How many different expressions were there? There were five. And yet in
Right.
Chazal, in our rabbinic literature, it refers to it as the four, and as if the fifth one about bringing us to the land is not included. And the question is why? You've heard answers about this? Have you
Not that
heard
I
the
can
question?
remember.
No, but you've heard the question?
Yeah.
Okay, that's a start. I heard an answer this week. My rabbi actually spoke about it in shul yesterday. And he said something that I was familiar with, but he said it in a way that I didn't put it together until he said it. He said a beautiful idea. Let's jump to the end of that sentence. It says, Hashem says that I will bring you to the land that I swore basically to give to your ancestors, Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. And here comes the expression, Vinasati oso lachem morasha. I will give it to you and I shall give it to you as an inheritance. Why? Ani Hashem, because I am Hashem. Does this word morasha sound familiar to anybody? Where you know this word.
Oh, Roz, teacher.
True, but the word morasha, I'll help you.
Russia? Is it Russia?
Morasha, not a Russia,
Oh, okay.
morasha, an inheritance. Think of something you know that we also call an inheritance, besides for the land of Israel.
Shabbos.
Close, there is a term there. I'll help you.
Tara.
I'm not a great singer, but it'll help. Torah, 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 Tzivalanu Moshe. What's the high part? Morasha kehilas Yaakov. Morasha kehilas Yaakov. Yes? Does it sound familiar to anybody? It should. If you've sent your kids to Hebrew school, it's one of the first things they teach. Torah tzivalanu Moshe, Torah that was commanded to us by Moses, Morasha kehilas Yaakov. Hey, those of you who are a part of Beth Jacob, you should know that phrase. Kehilas Yaakov. It's the kehila of Beit Yaakov. Come on, Beth Jacob. Anyway, Morasha is an inheritance. The Jewish people are told that the Torah is an inheritance to the Jewish people. Kehilat Yaakov, to the congregation of Jacob. It's also called a Morasha. On that verse, you find a very interesting piece of Talmud. The word morasha, which means an inheritance, the Talmud says you have to look a little deeper. Don't understand it and don't read it just as morasha, an inheritance, but almost as if you can change the vowelization and read it as meorasa. Not morasha, but meorasa. What does me'orasa mean? It means betrothed, engaged, soon to be married. That's a strange drasha. That's a strange way to make an exposition. Like, what does that mean? Sorry. Don't understand that the Torah is your inheritance. Rather, you should look at it that the Torah is betrothed to you. You're engaged to the Torah. Okay, what does that mean? That's the end of the Talmud. Doesn't seem to give much of an explanation. So I heard a beautiful insight. Do you ever hear of something called sudden wealth syndrome, SWS? It's an actual thing, sudden wealth syndrome. It's when a guy or gal inherits money that he was not anticipating. Long lost Uncle Jack passes away and leaves it to his great, great, great nephew. In the will, and all of a sudden the guy's into millions and millions that he had no idea. What happens typically with situations like that, is that the fellow will squander the wealth. He'll buy all the stuff he wants to buy, the luxuries. He'll go on cruises, he'll buy cars, he'll buy houses, he'll go gambling in Vegas. He'll spend it. And in a relatively short period of time, he squanders it. It's actually called sudden wealth syndrome. Why? What's the rationale? What's the psychology behind it? Is that because easy come, easy go? He didn't work for it. He didn't toil. He didn't work hard for it. He didn't put in any hours. You see, most of us, if we reach any level of financial security, it's because we earned it. We put in the time. Thank God we have a pension. We have a this. Okay, we have what we have. Why? Because we put in the time. Nobody here just inherited millions and millions and sat on their tuchus. That's not how it works. We all put in time. This guy, it's easy come, easy go. And therefore, he lacks a value of what money really is. He was given an incredible gift, an incredible opportunity, but he doesn't recognize it because he didn't put in any time and effort. So he squanders the opportunity and he wastes all the money. Say our sages that if you read and understand Torah is an inheritance, says the Talmud, don't treat the Torah like sudden wealth, like whatever, easy come, easy go. I was brought up, my parents told me about it. I did it. I went to Hebrew school, or I went to day school, or I went to the Kollel and I went to class, whatever. So this week I'm not going. This year I'm not going. You can't treat Torah like that kind of inheritance. You squander the opportunity. You can't say easy come, easy go. Torah is something that you have to toil in and you have to work so that you have the appreciation. The same way when you're engaged or betrothed to a woman, you know that it takes work. A relationship doesn't happen automatically. It takes work. Anybody who's ever been in a relationship knows that. If you take it for granted and you view it as easy come, easy go, you're in deep, you know what. I don't have to explain, right? Okay. We on our way to Arizona, listen to this true story. It just happened. On our way to Arizona, we made a stop in Vegas for a day. Okay. My son, who joined us later in the trip, on the way back, we stopped because we flew out of Vegas. So we were there for a couple of hours before we had to catch our flight. So we went to go see a show, whatever it was. So my son took one of our camper, one of our teens had to go to the bathroom. So our rule policy, you don't just let a kid walk off. So there's a staff member. So my son walks this kid to the bathroom, fine, goes into the bathroom and he's waiting outside. And a man comes up to him maybe 6, 7 minutes after he's standing there. And he says to him, is everything all right? I see you're standing here for a while. He says, no, I'm just waiting for someone to come out of the bathroom. He says, hey, this is Vegas. If she makes you wait another 2 minutes, get a different one. Whatever. True story. True story. It's like it's Vegas. Go get another one. That mindset is so dangerous. You can't treat the Torah that way. If you look at Morasha Kehilas Yaakov, that it's an inheritance for the Jewish people, but one that you don't take with the same level of seriousness that you do in a relationship that takes work and effort, then you squander the opportunity. Can't treat Torah like that. That's one type of inheritance that our sages are telling us don't fall into the trap of thinking that way. It takes work. But there's another kind of inheritance. And Rabbi Irving Bunim gives this example. And I think I remember sharing this when we learned Pirkei Avos a million years ago. He said the following, said that there's the one of the original Gutenberg Bibles that were first printed when the printing press was made. It's where is it? It was in the Brooklyn Public Library. It may still be, I don't know. But at the time he wrote this, it was in the Brooklyn Public Library under lock and key. It's under a glass case. And a guard would come once a week and turn a page so that it doesn't yellow and fine. But he pointed out, what is that? We call that an heirloom. Imagine you have something that's been passed down from your great-great-grandparents and got passed down to your grandparents, to your parents, to you, and you're going to give it to. But nobody ever reads it. No one ever uses it. It's an heirloom that's off limits. He says, then what good is it? Why, that you own it? Can you imagine? This is a Bible. A Bible, no matter what religion you're a part of, the Bible is meant to be learned and studied so that you can learn lessons from it. Putting it under lock and key if that's how we're going to treat the Torah as just a, using more relative, more contemporary terms, it's just going to be a coffee book table, you know, a coffee table book just sitting there, or something that you just keep behind a glass, you know, case somewhere, then what good is it? The Torah is an Eitz Chaim. The Torah is a tree of life. It has to be talking to us. We can't treat the Torah as something to squander or something just to keep behind lock and key. It has to be part and parcel of who we are, taking the effort to learn it, incorporate it into our life. This was something that I had already learned earlier. But what my rabbi yesterday said is that if you read this verse about Eretz Yisrael, about the land of Israel, it's the same word. I, Hashem says, and I will bring you to the land that I swore to the ancestors, Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, and I will give it to you as morashah, an inheritance. Do you know why this one's not included in the four or should be five expressions? Because this one's not a guarantee. The other four, God promised. He will take us out from the burdens of Egypt. He will take us away from their service. He will redeem us and he will take us to as a people. Those are guaranteed. Whether we get to stay in the land or not, there's no guarantee. He gave it to us, but it takes work. It takes effort. It takes a matter of a commitment. This is my land and this is where I'm going to be. And we are privileged to stay there. For 2,000 years, we did not have that privilege until 1948. We were given that privilege once again. And you know what? Maybe, I'm suggesting, I don't know if it's true, but maybe that's why we haven't had more than a few years of peace and tranquility. Because we're constantly being tested. Do you really going to work for it? Or are you just going to fall into a nice level of complacency and say, yeah, we're good. We're good. Every few years, the non-Jewish nations are testing us. Do you really committed to this? Are you going to fight for it? How committed are you? That's what the land requires. It's an inheritance, but it's the inheritance that you have to work for. The same way you work towards me'urasa and in relationship being engaged, it's true with our relationship with the land of Israel as well. So that's why perhaps it's not included as one of the five. It's a separate category. The other four are guaranteed. Those are expressions of redemption. God promised it. God brought it about. Not much effort on our part. The fifth one is a separate category. We have to earn it on a regular basis. Put in the time, put in the effort, put in the sweat, put in the tears, put in the money, put in everything we do to make it. This is our land. And that's on us. That's what he's saying. Yes.
No, I thought Yerusha means inheritance.
Same word. It's the same root. Yerusha and Morasha are the same root.
Oh, okay. So that's what I couldn't follow. Okay.
Yeah, Yerusha.
I was Yerusha.
Right. A Yerusha is the noun. It's the inheritance. Morasha is the act of bequeathing to someone else.
Okay, now I get it.
The
okay.
one who bequeaths is called the morish, and the one who inherits is called the yoresh.
Okay.
It's all the same word. It's just the syntax. Morasha, Yerusha is the same word.
Okay, I get it. Thank you.
Okay. It's a side point, but let's focus on these four expressions for a moment, okay? Let's ask, what do we do? As Mark correctly pointed out, every year at the Seder, we sit down and we have four cups of wine in corresponding to these four expressions of redemption, okay? So it's a pretty simple, straightforward expression. But here's the question. Let me ask, why is it done specifically on cup of wine? Why isn't it that we take, I don't know, four matzos at different points of the Seder? Why isn't it, I don't know, four scoops of charoset? Why is it specifically four cups of wine? Question to think about, but let's see, where do we use cups of wine on a regular basis?
The blessings.
Good. Any blessing?
The Kiddush. And
Kiddush. Good.
You bless, I think, the Haggadah. You bless the Haggadah story.
Okay, there are four points we do that. We'll get there. We're going to have to connect it to the Haggadah, yeah. But where else? Forget Pesach. Just in general. Let's stay even with Shabbos. You mentioned Kiddush.
Havdalah.
Oh, okay. So Fred brings down Havdalah. We start Shabbos with a cup of wine, and we end Shabbos with a cup of wine. Correct, gentlemen? Right? You have Kiddush to welcome in the Shabbos queen, and we have Havdalah that escorts it out. But Steve Nichols, I'm going to ask you the most obvious question. I understand that I have a cup of wine. Wine is always used for a simcha, for a joyous occasion. You have a cup of wine at a wedding. You have a cup of wine at a bris. You have a cup of wine for Kiddush. Havdalah doesn't seem to make sense. What is it that I'm celebrating? I should be crying my eyes out. Shabbos is over. I understand Kiddush. I want to use a cup of wine. I'm welcoming in Shabbos, the best day of the week.
The Havdalah is the start of something, not the end of something. It's
really?
Like the earning. You're earning. You're putting in to start the new week. You're earning that. You've been talking about earning, about the inheritance, and it's all connected.
So you're not wrong. You're not wrong, but let me ask you a question. What else do we use at the Havdalah ceremony?
We use the candle. We use the smell, the incense.
Perfect. So we use the candle. Why do we use the candle for Havdalah?
Because we can. No. What do you mean? It's a start. It's because we haven't been able to create energy, but we are starting something again. It's the same point.
Okay, you're quick on your feet, Steve. I like it.
Bring the light. Bring the light.
Okay, because fire was created on Saturday night. That's the real reason. Adam and Chava, after Shabbos was over, God gave them the wisdom to how to take the two flint rocks or two stone, whatever it was, and he created fire. Okay, fine. And how about spices? Why do we have spices? Because medical marijuana wasn't invented yet, so we were going
to delineate between the 2 days. That's it's creating a new start.
What's it got to do with smelling? I mean, I don't know what you guys are smelling, but for me, it's just smelling spices. I mean, it sounds like you're smelling stuff that you can't differentiate between A and B after that.
I don't know. Yes. Ask Brad Hoffman. I bet she's got the answer.
Okay, fine. Brad Hoffman, you're up.
Listen.
Why do we use spices? Come on.
You know. I thought it's supposed to like revive our souls between the, isn't it?
Our senses.
Souls.
Why?
Our souls.
Senses.
Why?
Our senses bring us aware of our awareness.
What's it got to do with smelling a bunch of cloves?
How special Shabbos is
for the week.
So then do it, Irv. So then do it Shabbos at Kiddush. Do it Friday night at Kiddush if it's so special for Shabbos. I seem to be saving it specifically for after Shabbos.
Yeah, because you want to remember something sweet when you're leaving it.
Ah, you guys are a bunch of little... hearted, come on, give me something solid.
Jack says neshama.
So Albert says something all the way from California. It's amazing how technology works. Amazing. Albert said, is because on Shabbos, we are given what's called as a neshama yisera, an extra soul. What that really means is an extra sensitivity to absorb the spirituality that Shabbos offers. We are given that special gift at the onset of Shabbos, over the course of as Shabbos is coming in, we are giving the extra soul. However, when Shabbos is over, that soul leaves and we are in mourning. In fact, the very last word of the Kiddush that we say Friday night before we make the bracha is, Givo Shavas Mikol Malachta Shabbos, Vayinafash. Right? Isn't that how the pas? It says, "Vayinafash." When we say Shabbos morning, "Vayinafash," the Gemara says is two words: "Vay" as in "oyvei nefesh," because of the loss of the soul. We lose a sense of our spiritual sensitivity when Shabbos leaves. And therefore, I'm tzebrochen. For those who don't understand Yiddish, I'm depressed. I'm broken. I feel yuck. And therefore, the sages say, smell something that's reviving for the soul. Smelling spices, making a bracha on spices is an uplifting, not just for the body, but even for the soul. We'll save another time why that is. We talked about it once, about the sense of smell never got tainted by the sin in Adam in the Garden of Eden. If you remember, great, don't worry about it. Okay. So that's the reason, Steve Nichol, is because smelling spices is to overcome a depression. I'm saddened that Shabbos is gone, and I'm losing that sense of spiritual sensitivity that I had. So now I go back to my original question. Why are we doing this on a cup of wine? This is nothing to be happy about. We should be crying. We should be sitting down and eating like we do on Tisha B'Av. We should sit down every Saturday night and eat a hard-boiled egg with ashes. Ah, Nebuch, Shabbos is over. Ay, 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 ay. Yet we do it with a cup of wine. Fair question, counselor, yes? Am I frozen?
Which counselor?
How many counselors we got here? Aren't you the counselor? Who else is a counselor here?
Brad.
Brad. I already picked on Brad. I'm not picking on him again.
We bring it through the week. I always thought we, all those signs of the smell, the flame, everything is to bring a bit of Shabbos with us through the week. It carries us through the week. Shabbos does.
I don't disagree with you, but I'm asking you a more basic question. I know that the reason we use spices is because of depression. That the soul is leaving us. So it's not a time for a cup of wine. I'm with you. If you want to tell me that we are marking the end of Shabbos to take something with us, great. But would you say that that's a joyous occasion? It doesn't seem to be that way. However, listen to the following. This is really, really important. If you look through Havdalah, what you find is something fascinating. How many different, what does the word Havdalah mean?
Separate.
Separation. That's exactly what the word means. Lahavdil means to draw a distinction, to separate A from B. In the Havdalah service, we make how many distinctions? Well, let's go through it. Baruch Adah Hashem Elokeinu Melech Haolam, Hamavdil, Bein Kodesh L'chol, that we separate between holy and mundane, Bein Or L'choshech, between light and darkness, Bein Yisrael lo'amim, between the Jewish people and the other nations. Bein Yom Hashvi'i l'sheshes yomei hamaseh, between the seventh day, i.e. Shabbos, and the other 6 days of the week. We make four clear distinctions. Jimmy, you got that? Four different kinds of Havdalah. We draw distinctions on four different ideas. Kodesh l'chol, between holiness and mundane. Bein or l'choshech, between light and darkness. Bein Yisrael l'amim, between the Jewish people and the other nations. And bein Yom HaShvi'i, the seventh day from the Sheshes Yimei Hamaseh, the 6 days of work. Those are, what do we say? Says Rav Avram Shor, in his Sefer on the Haggadah, he says these four cups of wine that we use at the Seder are corresponding to the four Havdalos, the four distinctions that we make in Havdalah. And he shows and proves it so beautifully. Watch. Where do we drink and make the bracha on the four cups of wine at the Seder? Let's go through it carefully. The very first cup, I'll forgive you if you don't remember. It's been, you know, 7, 8, 10 months already. I'll give you a bye. The first cup is said for Kiddush. That's what we always do. The first one is always on Kiddush. That always goes first. Okay? So first one is Kiddush. That corresponds to what we say, Bein Kodesh L'chol, the first Havdalah, right? You guys got this? Bein Kodesh L'chol is the first of the four. So it makes sense. The first cup of wine that I use at the Seder is Kiddush, to differentiate between the work day, and now Yom Tov, the special holy day. When's the next cup? When do we have the second one?
Before the meal.
When?
Before the meal.
Correct, but let's be more specific. It's after we said the entire Haggadah. We just did all of Maggid. You know, the stuff that everybody's like, come on, come on, come on, come on, come on, come on, come on. You know, that section. You know, everybody's asking the fifth question, when do we eat? Come on, you guys know what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. Right? So we do that. We said at that point. Now, it's very interesting. If you look carefully, what we actually do is we finish the story of the Exodus. We make a bracha, and we're going to drink the second cup. But there's something we do right before that. And that is we say
the
first two paragraphs of Hallel. Very good, Jim. We actually split the Hallel. If you pay attention in your Haggadah, what we normally call, let's say on Rosh Chodesh or on Yom Tov, we say what's known as Hallel. And it starts with Halleluka, Hallelu Avdei Hashem, chapter, I don't remember what it is. It is, hold on. It begins in Psalms. It is chapter 113. Okay? 113, 114. It goes all the way through. The very end is chapter 118. Okay? So 113 through 118. In the Haggadah, we say 113 and 114. Then we stop. We have our meal. We have matzah, maror, the meal. Then we bench. We make the drink the third cup. Then we do Hallel. And pretty much that is the ending. Do the fourth cup, and then we sing some songs. Do I have that right? Listen to what goes on here. The first cup of the Seder corresponds to the first being Kodesh Lachol, right? That makes sense between the holy and mundane. The second one is Bein Or Lachoshech, between light and darkness. It makes perfect sense. We just spent the last who knows how long talking about the fact that we were enslaved to Pharaoh and God took us out, and we talk about the whole redemption process. That's going from darkness to light. Redemption is moving out of darkness into light. Correct? The symbolism is very simple to understand. But then the third one is after we eat food. How strange is that? We're going to lift a cup and we're going to say, Hashem, you're the greatest. And we're going to bench and we're going to drink a cup of wine. What do you mean? Well, that's when we're going to do it. How about do it a little later? We're eating in the middle of Hallel. I did two paragraphs. Then I have my meal. And then after the meal, I have the rest of Hallel. What's up with that? And how does that correspond to the third of the Havdalos, Bein Yisrael La'amim, between the Jews and the other nations? Gentlemen, I have to share this with you. It's going to blow your socks off. And if you're not wearing socks, hold on. Okay. There's a halacha. If, let's say, I asked you very simply, who could I pick on here? I don't know. Jeff, I'm picking on you. Okay, Jeff, can a non-Jew bring an offering in the temple? When we had the temple in Jerusalem, can a Gentile come and bring an animal offering in the Beit HaMikdash? Yes or no?
No.
Depends on the context.
Okay, you could be the next president of Harvard. Jeff, it's a yes or no.
I'm guessing no.
You're saying no.
Right.
That is incorrect. The answer is yes. The answer is yes.
Trick question.
However, and this is probably what Eric meant. I'll give him the benefit of the doubt. I like his brother. And that is, it depends what kind of offering. Can let's say, can a non-Jew bring what's known as a shlamim, a peace offering, of where you bring the offering, part of it gets burned on the altar, part of it gets eaten by the owner of the offering, and part of it gets eaten by the Kohen. Can a non-Jew, can a Gentile bring that kind of karban? The answer is no, he cannot. Can a non-Jew, can a Gentile bring what's known as an ola, that which is burned completely on the altar? Nobody partakes of it. The answer is yes. The answer is yes. What is the difference between bringing an offering that's completely burned on the altar and that which is partly burned on the altar, partly eaten by a person and other people? What is the difference? An offering is an offering. What would you suggest? I'll tell you what the answer is. I love it. In the non-Jewish world, somebody who wants to be committed to God, somebody who is really engaged and focused and wants to serve their God completely, their motto is separate from the physical world. You can't live in both worlds. If you're going to be dedicated to God, then you have to take upon yourself certain vows to disconnect from the physical world. Partaking of the physical world is giving into you more, into your more base, more animalistic side. That's why in some religions, there are vows of celibacy, vows of silence, vows of poverty, because all the engagement with the physical world would seem counterintuitive, would be a contradiction to wanting to grow in the spiritual world. Spirituality and physicality, in their mindset, are contradictory. They're paradoxes that cannot coexist. Therefore, if they want to bring an offering to God, their mindset is, if I'm offering an offering, then it's got to be all for God. Don't tell me that this is an offering of where God's going to get part of it, but part of my forgiveness or part of my is where I get to partake of it. No, if this is for God, then I'm all in and it's for God. However, the Torah tells us that is not the Jewish way. Our perspective is that we can merge both physicality and spirituality. We are neither extreme. Angels are pure spiritual beings. Animals are pure physical beings. Human beings are the hybrid in between both. We have physical needs. We partake of the physical, but we elevate it to a spiritual level. I eat, but I make a bracha. I eat, but I have benching afterwards. I go ahead and I marry and I have children. I try to do all the things in the physical realm within parameters. Parameters that the Torah gives us that allows us to elevate the physical action to a higher purpose. That's everything we do. When we make a bracha, it even uses those terms. Baruch atah Hashem, blessed are you Hashem, Elokeinu melech haolam, our God, King of the universe, Asher kiddushanu, that you have sanctified us. How? B'mitzvotav, with the performance of a physical mitzvah. Yeah. Not by contemplating the cosmos. Not by moving out to the Himalayas and only dealing with the spiritual. No. I need to live in the physical world. So we are able to harness both physical and spiritual together. The non-Jewish world can't comprehend that. Either you're in the physical world or you're in the spiritual world. You can't be in both. Therefore, we in the Haggadah, what do? We go ahead and we say a little bit of Hallel, and then we finish. We make cup number two. We make our second cup. Fine. But then I eat a meal. I'm in the middle of Hallel, Irv. I'm in the middle of the most lofty praises for God. Spirituality 101. And what do? Time out. Time to fress. Time to eat. Let's get the matzah. Let's get the maror. Let's get the charoses. Let's get the brisket. Let's get all this stuff. Fill our stomachs. And then I bench. And guess what? comes cup number three. I take another cup of wine and I say, blessed are you, Hashem, that gives me the opportunity to be in the middle of Hallel, spirituality, and eating at the same time. That is Beit HaMavdil Bein Yisrael La'amim. That is the distinction between the Jewish people and the other nations. Smack in the middle of Hallel, I'm eating. Yeah, because we can combine both. And that's why the third cup specifically is right after we eat for benching. And then you come to the fourth one, which if you read the end of the Haggadah is all about the future redemption. It's not about the Exodus. We finished that when we closed out Magid. But after Hallel and we do Nirtzah and we do these other store parts of Hallel, it's all about the future redemption. The future redemption is what we would call the future Shabbos. That's what it is. Shabbos is a 1/60th of the world to come. So the last cup of wine we use at the Seder corresponds to that fourth Havdalah. Yom HaShvi'i, the seventh day, Mishesh Yisimei HaMasa, from the 6 days of the work week. So all four cups are an exact correspondence, one-to-one, with the four Havdalos we say every Saturday night. Rav Avram Shur wants to suggest that that's really what's going on here. These four terminologies that we talk about, that God says will take us out from the burdens, these four expressions correspond to the four cups of wine that correspond to the four major distinctions that we have in our life between Kodesh and Chol, between that which is holy and that which is mundane. What we have between light and darkness, between hostages, kidnapping, and freedom. There's a difference. Day 100 has now come and gone. And the hostages are still the hostages. They're in darkness. We daven that they will be fortunate to see the light again. They will be redeemed. There needs to be a distinction between Ar and Choshech. And there's a difference between the Jewish perspective and the non-Jewish perspective. And that revolves around using the physical world. And then you have the fourth one, which is the recognition that when God took us as a people and he gave us an opportunity to have a Torah, he gave us the key to success so that in the future, we have a world to come, that we have that ability to redeem all, cash in and be rewarded for all that we've done. These are the four expressions. Okay? You with me? Somewhat. Okay. Let me add one more thing. One more thing. It's something that my Rebbe said yesterday, but I had heard it earlier. Someone asked, there was a great leader who passed away only about within the last 10 years or so. His name was Rav Aaron Leib Steinman. He was a leader in Israel. He lived quite an old man. Was a tremendous leader. Someone asked him the following question. He said, why is it that the current gullus, the current exile that the Jewish people find themselves in, which has now been more than 2,000 years since the temple was destroyed and we've been dispersed around the world. It's 2,000 years. They asked Rabbi Aaron Leib, why is this exile so strange and so long? It makes no sense. You know, even when the Jewish people made the mistakes and this first temple was destroyed, how many years was it till the second one was built? How many years intervened between the destruction of Temple 1 and the completion of Temple 2? Grand total of 70 years, 70. Okay, that's an exile. We went through, we had to, and fine. So you want to tell me that after Temple 2 was destroyed and we had to suffer 100 years, 200 years, okay, 500 years, maybe. Yeah, you're pushing. 2,000 years? How can this be? It makes no sense. Rabbi Aaron Leib said the following. He turned to the fellow and he said, let me ask you a question. He says, if you look at the current situation in the world, it's only in the last few years that we have merited that people en masse are living long lives. It was unheard of. If somebody made it to 70, they lived a full life. Nowadays, if God forbid somebody passes away in their 70s, they all say, oh, he died young. People living into their 80s, nobody even blinks an eye anymore. It's nothing shocking. It's almost the norm. 90 is already, wow, okay, that's pretty good. 100, wow, you're really, but 70, 80, that's normal. But that's a recent development. Rev. Aaron Leib asked this fellow, why is it that we haven't had anything like this in history since the beginning of time? Why all of a sudden is it this way? And he answered the following. He said, what exile are we in right now? We're known as Gullus Edom. Edom. Edom is Esav. Remember Yaakov's brother, Esau? This is the Gullus. This is the exile, the Romans. The Romans are direct descendants of Esau. Western civilization is Esau's legacy. That is the Gullus. That is the exile we find ourselves in. Someone please tell me, Esav, as bad as he was a terrible person. We don't name people for him. He had one mitzvah that he excelled in. He did extremely well with. What was it?
He was a hunter.
What mitzvah?
Oh, okay.
Honored his father.
Yes, he honored his father. Oh, he did kibud av. He honored and had tremendous respect for his father. The Torah tells us that whenever he served his father, he put on his finest Shabbos clothing, so to say. He always did it respectfully. He got him whatever he wanted. Good, you tell me, maybe he had ulterior motives. But the fact is, he did tremendous kibud avaim, tremendous respect for his father. Rav Aaron Leib Steinman said that at the end of this exile, Hashem is giving us the final opportunity to go toe-to-toe with Esav. He's giving us an opportunity to take care of elderly parents. It was unheard of years ago. People passed away young. That's the way it was. Who ever heard of taking care of an 80-year-old, of a 90-year-old, with unfortunate now with health issues? It was unheard of 100 years ago? Impossible. Maybe one person, a fluke every now and then. But this is the norm now. Rav Aaron Leib said, because this is Hashem's way of saying, I'm going to get you out of this once and for all. The exile has done what it needs to do, and I'm giving you the chance to take down Esav, to go toe-to-toe with him. I'm going to give you the same opportunity for a mitzvah to take care of elderly parents. Friends, I am living this, as I'm sure many of you might be. I, Baruch Hashem, my mother's Lozayin Genzon, she should be well. She's in her mid-80s, and thank God she's doing great. But I have a father-in-law who's a little younger than that, who is not doing well. And it's the main, responsibility is on my wife and me. Not arguing, not complaining. I'm stating a fact. This sandwich generation, it's real. It's real. Taking care of elderly people with medical challenges. You have to do it with a smile that says, this is my chance to make a difference. This is my chance to do kibud av va'em, of showing honor to my mother and father. This is how we get out of this last redemption, out of this last exile. This is the last piece to the puzzle. This is how we have to, it takes, as I started with. Do you know why going back to the land of Israel is not one of the terms, expressions of redemption? I told you, because it takes toil, it takes effort, it takes work. This is our job, gentlemen. This is the work we have now. If we are still fortunate to have parents or aunts and uncles, people who are elderly that need our help, that have medical concerns and medical issues, or just unfortunately they're frail. This is our toil. This is our effort to bring this last expression home. This is our opportunity. This is how I inspire myself, because it's hard. It's not simple. My wife and I are always figuring out, can we do this? Can we do that? Well, if I go, then who's going to take care of Abba? And who's going to make sure that mommy is... You can't just blow it off and say, well, my life comes first. This is our avoda. This is our job. This is our toil and effort. And I'm 100% convinced, as the Torah itself promises, we do our part, Hashem will take care of the rest. That's how it works. We do our job. We put in the time. We put in the effort. And we daven that Hashem bless our efforts. That's how we bring this to a close. So when we read these stories in the Torah now, about this is the whole Exodus story. This is starting yesterday with the seven of the plagues and then the three. And then we're going to have the splitting of the sea and traveling in the desert and getting to Mount Sinai and getting the Torah. These are the next few weeks of the Torah readings. Think back to this conversation because these are the expressions of redemption. And that's the final piece of the puzzle. We're almost there. We're really, really close. I'm not a prophet. I'm not telling you any insider information. I'm just telling you what I see in front of me. We're watching prophecies that were said thousands of years ago coming true about the world. How can anybody look at the current situation of the world? How the lines are being drawn? Who is for Israel? Who is against Israel? And it's not just one neighboring country versus another. This is now spilling over into regional, and it's spilling over into world. The audacity of South Africa, right? The audacity to bring charges. Like, what? You have no say in this matter. What is wrong with you? But this is what we're watching. The prophets all told us this day is coming. Make sure you're on the right side, gentlemen. Make sure you're on the side that says, I'm with Hashem, I'm with Torah, I'm with the Jewish people. Because it is the winning ticket. It may not look like it sometimes, and it looks like overwhelming odds not in our favor. Don't bet against the Jewish people. Don't bet against God. You will lose. The Jewish people are here to stay. We are not going anywhere. Make sure you stay a part of it and read these stories about the Exodus from Egypt and say, this is our story now. We are watching the Exodus of the Jewish people. We are going back home. Okay, I'll get off my soapbox and hear any questions. Fine. Sure.
So I may have gone right over my head, but one of the questions was, you know, we have the four expressions, we drink four cups of wine. And you asked why wine? Why not four matzahs or for this?
Right. So the answer, I didn't speak it out as clearly as I should, but the answer is that all of the havdalos, all of the distinctions, what gives us the ability to distinguish between A and B? Brains. We have the ability to distinguish. What makes a one-year-old different than a five-year-old? A five-year-old's brain has developed at least a rudimentary understanding that you can draw a distinction between this and that. We celebrate that we have the knowledge to say there's a difference between Kodesh and Chol. We celebrate that we can draw a distinction between Or and Choshech, between Yisrael and the Amim, between Shabbos and the fact. That's what we're celebrating. And that's why we take a cup of wine specifically for Havdalah. Because Havdalah is the greatest gift we're given. That we can draw distinctions and say, this is not exactly like that. And therefore, I choose A and not B. That's the greatest joy we have. Thank you for asking that. I didn't speak that out clearly. That is the answer to the question. That when you go ahead and you have the ability to distinguish, that's the greatest joy. In fact, Jimmy, where do we say in the Shmona Esrei Saturday night when we daven Ma'ariv, we put in a paragraph called Atachonan Tanu, where we make those distinctions. In which bracha is it?
The one for wisdom.
The one for wisdom. Exactly. Because that's the greatest gift, that we can make distinctions. And this applies between good and wrong, between good and evil, right? Right and wrong, between this and that. If you lack any distinctions, I mean, let's be honest. In my opinion, we don't have to agree with me, but I think this is what is lacking in our society today. We have been brought into a world that now wants to get rid of all distinctions. Everybody's exactly the same. There's no distinction, male and female. Be whatever you want. And on Tuesdays and Thursdays, you can be this. Monday, Wednesday, Friday, you can be that. And we're all just the same. You can't make any distinctions because that's racist or that's discriminatory. That's not a Torah perspective. There are differences. It's not a right and wrong. It's a fact. Males and females, they're not exactly the same. The minute you start getting rid of all distinctions and everything is one and the same, you have basically downgraded society to an animal world. The greatest gift a human being has is to use their brain to make distinctions, compare and contrast, Venn diagram. I mean, I can use every analogy we've all been brought up with because there are distinctions. And if you can't make distinctions, then you've lowered everything. It's not utilizing what the one gift that makes us who we are. I don't know. My two cents. Maybe with inflation, it's a nickel now.
So what's the deal with this? So I agree. Like everything is upside down and crazy, and nobody's making distinctions. Like you say, everything's upside down. So, I mean, when does it end? Is God just finally just letting it go and go till it gets to the point like their punishment's not due yet, or what's the deal? When's he gonna step in and say, show himself or something? That's all this scum around us.
The answer is, I don't know. I don't know. I'm not that high up on the pecking order to know exactly when. The truth is, our prophets themselves say the exact timing of it is unknown. But I'm telling you, Jeff, the world is spinning at a pace that there is no choice. Something is going to have to give. The world cannot keep going for an extended period of time like this. It just can't. And we're watching, I don't know, I have a different perspective. I'm watching like everything else. I see things on a micro level and I see things on a macro level. You can't get blinded by one or the other. You have to see two things working. On a micro level, you see the society, you know, the fact that all across the world in what's known as the civilized world, in the Western culture, the standards of ethics and values are unraveling at a pace that is unfathomable. But at the same time, you can't ignore the macro picture of what's going on around the world, not necessarily the ethical issue, but about just simple, the Jewish people. How does this small little 15, 16 million people take such a center stage in the world? It makes no sense. Every country that's screaming has 10 times the numbers of citizens. We're like a fraction. And yet the world is drawing its pro and con all around this tiny little state of a tiny little people. The answer is because this is the center point of what's going to be determined. There's no choice in that. It is what it is. We cannot run from this. If the Holocaust taught us anything, it's you cannot hide from your Jewishness. It is. You can't say I'm only 1/8 Jewish. You are or you're not. Pick your side. How it's going to play out, Jeff, I have no idea. But you can't be blinded and just say, today's just a regular Sunday. Oh, yeah, January 14th, just a regular, you know, nothing going on. You know, you can't. You can't get up tomorrow morning and just assume it's a regular Monday. We are one step closer to this being played out on a world stage. There's no other way to say it. But don't ask me for details because I have no idea.
It's kind of like the right and the wrong of how the world sees itself. I think Israel has learned that some of the countries that they didn't think supported them did not support them do, and those that they thought did don't. And it's about creating this balance of right and wrong. and the Jewish people have so much respect. As you say, we're like a, you know, pizzle of salt amongst the world population, but there's something that's in that, there's something that we share with the world that we bring for the betterment of all. And I think they get, you know, there's those that get it and there are those that will continue. We're not going to get everybody, but, you know, I still, you know, it's the good side. It's just taking its time to work through.
Yeah, it's and you know, I try to be an optimist, and I'd like to think that ultimately we will, you know, on our own world. But a part of me is like, you know, there's certain segment of the world population that is just not going to get it, and they're going to fight it till the very end. That's just the way it will be. But Jeff, I don't know when. I don't know. Do me a favor. Don't make any plans for 2028. I don't know. Don't make plans. Don't go that far in advance. Let's stick with 2024 for now.
Okay. Sounds good.
Anyway, something to think about when it comes to these expressions of redemption, all right? Any questions?
Thank you.
Huh? We're good?
Yeah, thank you.
All right.
Thank you.
Good. My pleasure.
Thank you.